Thank you very much, Lydia. I am honored to be here today. Before I start, I guess I should pay tribute to my staff that's here. You know, it's always nice when the boss has their fan club with them. I have four members of my staff here, Margaret, Geraldine, Ellen, and Marcella. So if they would just stand, I'd like for you to see some other distinguished women in government. In the Office of Revenue Sharing, many of them have very influential roles, and I would like to tell you a little bit about the function of the office. Lydia told me that she thought I should kind of combine the function of the office with my own private personal life, and I guess a little bit about how I got there. And I have another friend here over here clicking the camera away who's really, we could reminisce Houston in 1970. We were here together for a national YWCA convention where we dealt with many of the same issues that the National Women's Conference is dealing with, and it's kind of Houston revisited. But my personal life really, I guess, serves more to help women understand that we can change our profession after we get a little more mature. You heard her say that I started out as an educator and a teacher, but prior to that, I was a YWCA volunteer and then taught swimming at the YWCA. Through my work at the YWCA, I was able to have role models, the female professional staff members. My own personal background is one from a very low-income housing project in Detroit. And going to the YWCA in Detroit, I was able to see black professional women who, to me, served as role models. And they apparently saw some leadership qualities in me because they encouraged me from the age of 16 to go to school, and they would help me go to school. And I guess the teaching is something that the Lord gave me, because I've always just had beautiful experiences with having captive audiences, and he made me a very loquacious person, and I guess that makes for a good teacher. The YWCA has been instrumental. I guess it helps with my present position because we have been very social action oriented, and public affairs have been at the top of the list of everything that we've done around the country. And so you could kind of tie it in together. I went on to college at an old state normal college where all 4 years were spent helping us to become teachers. When I went to the University of Michigan, I guess I went partially as a challenge because I saw, and Marcel and I, she never likes for me to say this, but we started out teaching together about 26 years ago, and we saw a different caliber of teachers coming out. And so it kind of raised my curiosity about, you know, what was the difference between those of us that came out, you know, 26, 27 years ago and the young people who are coming out today. And so I accepted a challenge to go to the University of Michigan to try to train some teachers for the urban areas. I think part of the problem was we went 4 years to state teachers' colleges, and we were 4 years being trained to be teachers. When I got to the university, and I guess most universities are the same, you don't go into the school or the college of education until you are a junior, and that leaves you only 2 years to make a teacher out of these young folks that have been sent to you for training. I presume if I had a lot of time to do research, that would be a topic I'd like to research. If we brought back the old normal colleges to train teachers, if maybe Johnny might learn to read again. And I'm not sure that that would be true, but it would be worth looking into. Anyway, I moved on from teaching into counseling, into administration, and lo and behold, here I am with federal government as of about 7 months ago. And so it's been a very fascinating and challenging experience. It relates to some of the experiences that we had in the public schools, because administration is administration and people are people. So you use many of the skills that you developed as you worked with people over the years. My primary interest in the first year at the Revenue Sharing Office is a public awareness program, and that's why when they asked me to participate in this series, this lecture series, I looked upon it as an opportunity to promote our public awareness program. We have a booth, and my staff members have been manning it very well. That's right. We're manning it. Yeah. Anything other than manning it. Yes. Yes, staffing it. Peopling it. But anyway, no, that's true. We do have to be sensitized to that, and I am one who really thinks I'm quite sensitive to that, and even I've been brainwashed, you know. But anyway, they've been over there, and the little while that I spent over there, people would come over and say, you know, revenue sharing, what is that? You know, revenue sharing, what is that? And so I'm delighted to have this opportunity to try to tell you a little bit about what it is. I assume that's why you're here, that you want to know a little bit more about revenue sharing. How many of you feel you already know something about it, and staff, people leave your hand down? Well, we have about three or four. Okay. That's better than most presentations that I make. Most presentations that I make, very few people know anything about it. So I try to tell you what the function of the Office of Revenue Sharing is, and that is first to provide fiscal assistance to some 39,000 state and local units of government. In our office, we run two programs, the General Revenue Sharing Program, which runs about $6.8 billion a year, and the Anti-Recession Fiscal Assistance Program, which runs about $2.2 billion a year. We're there to see that the law is implemented to enforce all the provisions of the law. The law came into existence in 1972 as Title I of the State and Local Fiscal Assistance Act. It was to return a portion of your federal income tax monies back to the state and local governments so that you could make some decisions at the local level about how this money was spent, rather than have those of us in Washington sit, as I say, in our ivory towers and decide what's best for you at the local community level. So this money comes in. The law states each year how much money we are to give out. I should say that one of the most frequently asked questions is, you know, how do we get an application and what kind of a proposal do we have to write? It is not a grant program. It is an entitlement program. State and local units of government are entitled to receive these monies. They don't have to write any proposals, and they don't have to fill out a lot of complicated applications. We're set up in our office in nine divisions to carry out this responsibility. Some of the staff members here, that's pretty well represented. We have three compliance divisions that our public awareness program tries to speak to. I choose to call it our trilogy of compliance. In 1972, when the program was first implemented, it ran for a short period of time. The 72 law expired in December of 76. And then we had the 76 amendments, which took effect July 1 of this year, 1977. In the 76 amendments, they strengthened the compliance requirements. Revenue sharing was advertised in the original law as a no-strings-attached program, and a lot of people saw it as displacing the other Model Cities programs, displacing the human service delivery programs. But this, I don't think, is necessarily the case. What we are saying with the revenue sharing money is that instead of us sending it out as a categorical grant or as block grants, we give it to you as an entitlement, and then you as citizens will help make the decision for how it is spent. We have a few strings now attached to it in the 76 amendments, which make up the trilogy of compliance. The first one is the audit requirement, and Ellen is a part of that division. Prior to the 76th Amendment, any auditing of revenue sharing spending was a voluntary thing. We had agreements with about 43 states around the country that we would work with their state auditors, and if while they were auditing the state and local books, they saw anything that they suspected as being an illegal expenditure of revenue sharing funds, then they would call our office. The 76th amendments, however, make it now mandatory that any unit of government that receives over $25,000 must have an independent audit of its financial statement according to generally accepted auditing standards at least once every 3 years. Now, this is a whole new ball game. You remember I said at first it was a voluntary thing of revenue sharing funds. Now we're saying it is a mandatory thing of all your financial statements. So this has caused a wee bit of confusion. We have tried to write some regulations to implement the law that would not cause a lot of red tape and bureaucratic gobbledygook, as people say. But it's something that we have to enforce. That's just a little bit about the audit requirements. We don't have anybody in here from our public participation. But the second leg of the trilogy speaks to public participation. And this was brought about by a lot of special interest groups, public interest groups, and I could start naming them, but I would probably leave some out. But they brought a lot of pressure for these monies to be expended in a way so that local citizens had some input. So we have the public participation requirement, and now we have to have these two hearings that I will speak to you about a little later. And the third leg of the trilogy is the enforcement and the strengthening of our human and civil rights provisions of the revenue sharing law. We have 9 divisions that support and help carry out this enforcement in these 3 compliance areas. Now, you would imagine that in most federal offices, we would have a whole lot of people giving out almost $10 billion to 39,000 units of government. But that's not true in the revenue sharing office. We have a very small, dedicated staff. We think that we might get up to 200 before the end of this fiscal year 78. So we're operating with less than 200 people, and we are giving out 59,000 checks every 90 days. So that means that all of the divisions that are within the Office of Revenue Sharing have to operate on a very tight schedule, because anything that falls off the schedule, you know, it throws just a monkey wrench into the whole thing. And if those 59,000 checks are not out 5 days, you know, at the beginning of the quarter of the year, telephone calls start coming in, and mayors and city managers and commissioners and selectmen and everybody else, because they are building, in some cases, as much as 10% of their budget is coming to them from our office. And when you're operating as an elected official and you have to go to some of your constituents and say, well, you know, the checks didn't get out on time, and so we've got to lay off 1,000 firefighters, or we have to lay off, you know, 2,500 police officers because, you know, those 200 people in Washington didn't pump out those 59,000 checks. So we have to work very closely as a tight-knit organization, because the Data and Demography Division, which is the division that receives all the information from the Census Bureau, that's another misnomer. A lot of people don't understand that we don't gather the census, we don't decide on the amount of money. The amount of money in each entitlement period is spelled out in the law. The formula is spelled out in the law. The law tells us that we have to receive the data from census, and so we have to work very closely with census to make sure that they get us the data in time for the Systems and Operation Division to receive it from our Data and Demography Division, get it into the computer, divide it up into the 39,000 units of government according to the formula, and then be ready to crank out all those checks every 90 days. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the staff in that office because it is quite a job, and they have never missed getting those checks out on time. As a result of that, we have in our office what is known as a little check party. And I'm not sure that it really expresses the front office's appreciation for how hard the, you know, federal employees work to do that. But we do every 90 days, if we make it, we have a little celebration, and everybody kind of relaxes, you know, for about 2 days, and then you get started and gear up for the next check that has to come out. So our operating expenses are very, very low. We do not have any regional offices. We just send our investigators out into the field. We have about 28 auditors, give or take a little, Ellen. We have about 50 civil rights investigators, give or take a little bit. And we have about 20 program analysts who go out and assist the community with understanding how they can participate in these decisions. What I've done since I've been there is to try to maintain the reputation that the office has of not being a traditionally red tape, bureaucratic federal agency. We try to make it as simple as we can, because you see, if it's simple for the state and local jurisdictions, then it is a little simpler for us because we don't have as many complaints or as many problems. I've tried to establish a kind of a climate in the office where the staff members know that I have an open door policy, because I feel very strongly that because the bureaucracy can get to be very impersonal at times, that they ought to feel that they can get to the top leadership in the office if they have some concerns about how things are not moving as best as they can. So we try to operate with an open door policy. We try to be candid with one another in our office, and we try to let them know that without the troops, you know, there's no place we can go. My deputy says that we're the coaches and all the employees are the team members. And, you know, if you don't have a good team, what happens to the coaches? And if you don't have a good record, what happens to the coaches? So we really depend upon our staff members to be that important cog in the wheel that we know they are. I was explaining to them the other day, and I tried to find an analogy that would make sense to them, and I talked about symphony orchestra and how, you know, I can stand up here with the baton and I can be the leader of the office and I can do all these things, you know, but unless I have a violin section that has, you know, the first violinist, unless I have a wind section, unless I have a percussion session, we're not going to make beautiful music together. So we are working very hard in our office to have this togetherness and to have a harmonious relationship, and most of all, have them know that it is not a we and they situation, but we're all working together for the Office of Revenue Sharing. In our public awareness program, we try to help people understand how they can use this money. Now, I said briefly that there were no strings attached to it. I keep telling you all these strings that we've added. In fact, when I was out in Los Angeles, a man told me, he says, they're not strings, they're ropes that you got around our neck. But it's supposed to be a no-strings-attached program. But you have to use the money. The state and local jurisdictions have to use the money for any purpose as long as it's legal under their own law. They can't, for example, do anything with revenue-sharing money that they could not do with their own funds. One other little thing is it must be expended, it has to be used, obligated, or appropriated within 24 months in the revenue sharing program. In the second program, the anti-recession program, which was a part of the economic stimulus package, That had to be spent in 6 months, and we'll talk about that a little later. But the revenue sharing, as it was amended in 1976, was for more money than the first time around. This time it is for $25.5 billion, and it runs for 3 3/4 years. It started January 1 of this year, and it will go through September 30th of 1980, which means that back, you know, in the home districts of all of the women who are here, if we could ever get this public awareness program through to all of them, you need to start working with your elected officials. You need to start letting your representatives know that if it's a program that is successful in your community, that you would like to see it extended, because it means that about this time next year, we'll have to start getting ready for renewal. And it'll be up to you to help us. It's a partnership. When we talk about less than 200 people to cover 39,000 units of government, if you're not in partnership with us, you know, there are a lot of things that could be going on with that revenue sharing money, which violates the law, that we would have no way of knowing if we could not depend upon you to work with us. In our public awareness program, as we speak to groups, we ask your help to monitor what's going on with the revenue sharing money in your own community. We can set out the regulations and the guidelines and say the law says that a third of it goes to the state and 2/3 of it goes to local jurisdictions. That's fine for us to say it. That's the way we send it out. But we have to be comfortable to know that we've got some good, strong female out there letting those elected officials who are primarily male know that you know what's coming in there in the way of revenue sharing funds, and that you want them to be held accountable for it, and that you will go to the public hearings and you will ask all the necessary questions. When you go to the hearings, chances are, if you belong to AAUW or NCNW or any of the national organizations around, if your organization, YWCA, can't forget all those. You see, when you start naming things, you get in trouble. But if you go to any of the public hearings representing any of the groups that you belong to, chances are you will be heard. You remember I said this started in January of this year. And so the word is really not out the way it should be out. And we received the clippings from all around the country. My own city of Detroit, who gets about $40 million, and two people came to the hearing. We get clippings that are really kind of mimicking the whole system after people fought very hard for citizen input, because only one person showed up. Or we had a call that said, well, you said we had to have this hearing, and we had the hearing, and nobody came, so how are you going to know that we really had the hearing? We said, well, chances are you had some minutes. You know, if it was an official meeting and hearing, you have some minutes, and you can document the fact that you had the meeting. So we encourage you to help us spread the word, call the city hall, ask people how much money came in revenue sharing funds, ask them what they did with it, ask them when will they have the next hearing, the proposed use hearing, because you want to come and say some things that you would like to see on that grocery list. We call it a grocery list because all of us have our special interests. And as we go to a public hearing and they're talking about the proposed uses of revenue sharing, well, you know I'm going to get my special agenda in there, and you're going to get yours, and you're going to get yours, and you're going to get yours, and you're going to get yours. And then it's up to the governing body, the legislative body, to make the decisions on how they're going to prioritize and decide what they're going to spend the money for. That's not the end of your responsibility. You have to come back to the next hearing and see what did they decide to spend the money for before they adopt the budget. And as you go back to that budget hearing, sit and listen to see if my agenda got in, or yours, or yours, or yours. And if mine didn't get in this year, still doesn't end my responsibility. Because I want to come back and help the sister over here monitor hers if hers got in and mine didn't, you see. And then next year, I'm going to help her monitor hers, and then the next year when we go back for the proposed use hearing, she will know that we're working in a partnership together, and she's going to help me get mine through the next year. So it's a kind of a cooperative effort. Yes? That's right. That's right. Yes. I brought a sample of what we call an actual use report. Anybody, you know, they're available for public record. I'll put one out here so you can see what it looks like. So that if you go into your city hall and ask for the actual use report of the revenue sharing expenditures, you know what to look for, you see. Until this year, we had a proposed use report, and they sent one in at the beginning of the year and told us what they thought they were going to use the money for, and that really didn't work. And this is why we are putting in these proposed use hearings, because it's better for you to go to the hearing and let them say and listen to you rather than for them to send us a piece of paper into Washington. Because they could send us in a proposed use report and say they're going to use the money for health, education, for recreation, for transportation, for environmental protection, and they could say all that. And to us, it doesn't mean much more than this piece of paper. But if you're sitting right there in those hearings and they say, well, we're going to use the money for recreation, well, you can say, for whom? Senior citizens? You know, for the children in low-income areas? What are you going to use? You can have that feedback that we can't have with a piece of paper. But they are required to file this actual use report. We're experimenting this year with a new way of doing it. It's such a new program. We're still having growing pains, you see. And we try things, and we really want to do it the best way possible to meet the needs of the recipients. Even this actual use report that you can see if you go down to the city hall, the only thing this one says is that it spent $17,358,000 of revenue sharing money on recreation. You know, it doesn't tell me where. You know, it doesn't tell me if it was equally divided, you know, according to Title IX rules. It doesn't tell me any of that. So we have to depend upon the citizens, you know, to really monitor that. During the last renewal, some of the people on the Hill said, you know, with that little staff that you have, and you're not really doing the things that, you know, we've mandated you to do, how in the world do you think your statisticians also? Well, they wanted to know why the Census Bureau wasn't collecting the actual use report. So we're experimenting this year. We have contracted with the Census Bureau to collect our actual use reports as they collect their annual data. So this time next year, I might have a different form to show you, but we might have more accurate information because we're interested in trying to get as much accurate information as we can. That tells you a little bit about those two hearings that I really want you to watch for and to see that they're carried out. And that all was in the public participation part of the amendment. To go back, yes. The program is 5 years old, and money has been withheld twice. Once in the Chicago case that most of you are probably familiar with the police department. There was some $130 million because of the discrimination in the police department. And in my own state of Michigan, the city of Ferndale had their funds put in escrow for a little while. I was going to go to audit, but let me go to human and civil rights and see if I can tell you a little bit about this whole thing that you're mentioning on discrimination and noncompliance with the revenue sharing law. The amendments in 76 added three protected classes. The revenue sharing law says that no person, you know, we just got through trying to help people understand that we are persons. No person shall be denied the benefits of, be discriminated against in the use of the revenue sharing funds based on race, sex, national origin, religion, handicap status, or age. So that is really a lot of protection for these protected classes. When, if you recall, I said in some instances it's 10% of their budget. So if you have an elected official who is going to his constituency and saying that, you know, because we don't hire women as firefighters, you know, those people in the revenue sharing office are talking about taking 10% of our budget away. We have a lot more progress with women firefighters than we ever had before. The same in the police departments across the country. Revenue sharing funds for minorities and women as police officers. And I have had some of the elected officials come in and say to me, you know, there's no way that women can be firemen, and I say firefighters. You know, that's why I say I'm very sensitive to that, and that's why it was interesting that I should use that, because I'm always correcting everybody else. But I also had to say to one particular city official that he's talking to a former physical education major, me. We played football, we climbed ropes, you know, we ran hurdles. We did everything that the men did. So he's going to tell me now that women can't climb ropes and be firefighters. I said, you have to take that story to somebody else, you know, because I'm not going to listen to it.